Well, hello. It's really a huge honour to have been asked to come and speak to you at this event today. And so I must begin by thanking everyone who has helped to make it possible for me to travel from Australia for this conference. So thank you very much for that, and I think especially to Alexandra for all her work organising a fantastic day. And I hope that I can say something of interest as we conclude today's series of talks. So, in January 1980, Arvo Pärt and his family made a very difficult journey. For someone like me, an Australian, from a much younger generation with no experience of the institutional forces that affected so many Soviet lives, to imagine this journey is simply impossible. Arvo had kidney troubles. He and Nora had two small children. The situation in Estonia had become untenable. They emigrated with no money, no set destination, no future certainty, and no real hope of ever again seeing their friends, colleagues, and homeland. A young student, Tuomas Siton, offered to help them as far as the border. Pärt had informally mentored Tuomas since high school, when Tuomas wrote his thesis on pro et contra. I think it's the first work in the long career that we're celebrating today. Nora's aunt was also on the train, and between Tartu and Vilnius, they were joined by the filmmaker, Grigory Kromanov. Tuomas remembers that the mood was very hard. In 2005, when he spoke to Arvo and Nora about this journey, he realized that this time in their lives had been so turbulent, so exhausting, that many of the details had slipped from their memories. At last, the train reached the final threshold, the station terminal at the border city of Brest. The Pärts had heard rumours of the treatment given to Nemi Järvi's family at this same place the week before, and were full of apprehension. Tuomas could not join the family in the customs area. He could only peer through a gate. And he did not quite see or hear what happened next, the unforgettable scene reported by Nora to Enzo Restagno. The border officers placed a cassette with Tintinabuli recordings in the player, and Pärt's music sounded through the huge hall. Suddenly, the tension was released. Everything became a bit calmer. The officers were quite kind, and eventually the family passed on their way. Tuomas had stayed the whole time, and he was able to exchange with Arvo one last wordless gesture of goodbye, a goodbye forever, before they went out of view. Now today, we are still not quite sure if this tape from Brest still exists, but because we do have some other recordings of Pärt music from this time, we can try to approximate. Nora has said that one of the works played was Missa Syllabica. So what they heard may have sounded something like this recording, the same one from Riga in 1977, which we've also heard in Kevin's paper. I think this recording challenges us very much today. We cannot imagine ourselves back in that station at Brest, but also I think we cannot erase the history of Pärt since 1980 from our own ears. The tape is very familiar, and yet, as Kevin said, so different to the Pärt sound that we know and expect today in concerts and recordings. And so these echoes of Tintinabuli from the threshold of Pärt's emigration force us to confront the complex effect of that moment on his later musical identity. In biographical accounts of Pärt, 1976, the first year of the Tintinabuli style, is usually marked as the key point. But in the context of Perth reception, as Oliver Kautny has shown, Perth's emigration instead becomes the key event. And different perspectives on this moment have shaped very different and highly contested understandings of Perth's music and its meanings. This has been true on both sides of the so-called Iron Curtain. One extreme example comes from this New York concert of Perth's music in 1984, in which Tintinnabuli was presented by the Continuum Ensemble as dissident art, a music of resistance, its possible meanings dominated by the Cold War clichés of a fevered Western imagination. Another example, equally extreme, is the total absence of Perth's name from Estonian music encyclopedias and other texts in the early 1980s. His emigration, which led to his status as persona non grata, snap froze official debate around his music's affective and ideological content. And I shall return to these examples a little bit later. But if the sounds we heard just now seemed so alien, it is partly because we are so accustomed to a sound aesthetic for Tintinnabuli that was shaped by the ECM recording label and by interpreters schooled in early music performance practice. The 1977 tape reveals how the most canonical of Tintinnabuli works, including Passio, today have an identity that splits around Perth's emigration. Their notated form took shape in the East, but their authoritative sounding form only in the West. Digging a little deeper, we might notice that when Estonians first heard Tintinnabuli music in the raw Hortus Musicus performances of 1976, the initial evaluation was uncertain, even from normally staunch supporters of Perth, such as Marika Weitmar. Could it be that Tintinnabuli, as we now recognise and value it, could only have formed under the impure conditions of a Western marketplace, aided by clever image building and the conditions of commodification and technologisation that Kautny has described as preconditions for a successful reception of Perth's counter-aesthetic of stillness, reduction, nature, and harmony? These shifting sound worlds and their associated receptions also reflect Perth's journey from Tallinn through Brest to Vienna. Are the ECM Tintinnabuli and the earlier Soviet Estonian Tintinnabuli, which we just heard, the same or different? And how do we incorporate the fact and consequences of emigration into our efforts to diagnose and label the aesthetic features of this music? We might also understand the experience of the Perth family on this journey, which they shared with Tuomas Siitan, in terms of violence. His crossing of the Soviet border, after all, was not entirely voluntary. It had been brought about largely by institutional forces, behind whose authority was always the possibility of real, literal violence. And the permanency of the crossing itself perpetrated more violence in a metaphorical sense, the sense of self-fragmentation, the ripping away of Perth's roots, and the contexts that had sustained his personal and musical identity. Such dislocations have been all too common in a war-torn and politically divided Europe. And if we think this way, the story of the tape and its soothing effect is particularly remarkable, because at Brest, the Perth family heard Tintinnabuli music the same way in which it is reported by other listeners, as a moment of beauty and peace, a source of sustenance at a painful and existentially confronting time. Suddenly, the scene at the station becomes a metaphor for one of the most powerful discourses in Tintinnabuli reception, the style's capacity to engage with, express, and even help to heal the experience of violence and trauma. Maria Chismik and Kaira Maimets have studied this phenomenon very well, and I mention it today to indicate how Perth's emigration links directly to some of the very deepest questions we can ask of the meanings held by Tintinnabuli, in the sense intended by the Icelandic singer Björk when she remarked that Perth had the whole battle of the 20th century inside him. And so this journey that Perth took in 1980 has come to organise very many perspectives on his music, all fragmentary. Among the divergences, though, there are also some recurring patterns, and in my remaining time, I want to trace two patterns that I myself have found especially interesting while researching Perth from within Estonia. But I should say that I have many more questions than answers. My perspective is, of course, an outsider's, and I hope to learn from you, perhaps afterwards today, much more than you can learn from me. So, I next want to talk about Pärt's first period, where he wrote 12-tone and collage music. Most listeners from outside former Soviet spaces are still unfamiliar with these early works. These compositions just did not cross the border with Pärt in the same way that Tintinnabuli music did. And so I want to suggest that this geographical split, this different awareness of Pärt's music as a whole, can lead to very different aesthetic understandings of the Tintinnabuli style. Back in 2002, Kautny identified a defining theme of Pärt's reception outside the former USSR, that his early works almost never take on real significance in discussion. Instead, Western listeners have been encouraged to interpret Tintinnabuli in relation to other musical reference points, such as American minimalism, as well as certain persistent tropes that mythologize Pärt himself: the Soviet dissident, the spiritual ascetic, and the West as a site of cultural pluralism and freedom. As we saw with the continuum concept, Pärt's émigré status was central to some of those myths. Kautny, and more recently other writers like Kevin Carnes and Laura Dolp, have done very much to deconstruct this stereotypical Western imagination of Pärt and Tintinnabuli. Yet today, Kautny's basic observation remains fundamentally true. Look at ECM, Pärt's primary label, who almost never, until I think this year, released his 1960s music. Or look at books such as The Cambridge Companion to Arvo Pärt, or Arvo Pärt's White Light, where the Western contributors barely mention Pärt's music before 1976. Critics still habitually write as though Tintinnabuli is Pärt's only true and valuable music, a style which stands apart from his earlier works, and which can be understood without the frame of reference that those early works offer. The dividing line drawn by emigration across Pärt's repertoire has thus been powerful and enduring. As Dolp puts it, any continuity in his compositional process has been systematically pushed to the background. It seems to me, though, that Estonians in particular have always had a different perspective. For example, here we have Uno Soomere proposing some distinctive features of Pärt's overall style, including the meticulous selection of musical ideas through clear and concise starting material, development by accumulation, a targeted expressive motion, and a carefully weighed up approach to formal detail. Finally, Soomere mentions a close bond between the rational and the feelingful, and says on the slide here that at the forefront of the realization of Pärt's creative thoughts is a strict calculation of the expressive resources. Now, I think these words give a pretty good description of Tintinnabuli, but they actually come from the early 1970s, well before Tintinnabuli. We thus see the difference that comes from a knowledge of Pärt's full repertory. For Soomere, I think it would have been obvious that Tintinnabuli must be understood continuously with the earlier works. Ridiculous to suggest otherwise. It was a new direction, yes, but this composer often took new directions, and there was no change to the fundamental underlying compositional identity. Now, Soomere is not the only example, of course. Estonian writing has consistently recognized the links between Pärt's 12-tone music and the strictness of Tintinnabuli. Merike Weitmar made this very point in reviewing the very first Tintinnabuli concert in Sirpjavasar in 1976. We find it again in expatriate Harry Alt's 1980 book, Estonian Music. And in this overview of prominent Estonian musicians, we still find the same links. Even in 2004, Pärt's 1960s music is still considered important when describing the fundamental Tintinnabuli style. And as Carnes has observed, we also find this pattern in writing by Svetlana Savenko, another musicologist from the former Soviet space within which Pärt's early music has mostly circulated. Another striking comment came from Weitmar in 2000, who took the opposite view to many in the West when she wrote that Pärt's meditative works were only static at first glance, that they in fact were all dramaturgically constructed. And this is a comment that comes, I think, much more naturally to one who well knows the communicative intent of Pärt's Symphony No. 2, or Perpetuum Mobile. And for me, personally, this is a more helpful remark than most writing by, say, Wolfgang Sandner. So, Perth's emigration has helped to shape these two very different frameworks within which listeners can attach meaning to his Tintinnabuli music. I think researchers like us would benefit from a long study of the music that Perth left behind at the border, and which has since been ignored outside Estonia, music which also includes his children's songs, like Mina Olen Juvasur, and his film scores, like Uku Aru. And this is something about which I would love to hear your thoughts later. But now I want to raise one other quite difficult question, which is whether and how Perth's Tintinnabuli music may be understood as Estonian music. And this story is not linear. It is highly fragmented on both a personal and a geopolitical level. And I really have no fixed view myself. Instead, what I want to do is mention some of the major events as I understand them, and you may like to correct me, and then to offer some observations for your consideration. So, even before Tintinnabuli, before emigration, attempts to include Perth in a historical narrative of Estonian music were contentious. Of course, the Soviet-Estonian discourse on national identity was very different to what we find today. But as early as 1965, we find some scholars like Ophelia Tuisk arguing in Sir Pievasar that Perth, along with Kuldar Sink, were national in their progressive attitudes, while other scholars criticised them, saying that they lacked engagement with folklore traditions. And this ground continued to shift in Perth's official reception throughout the 1960s. The difficulties were greatly increased by the fact of Perth's emigration. As I mentioned earlier, the discourse ruptured completely, as he was literally written out of Estonia's official music history. But meanwhile, of course, his music moved on. By the time of his critical rehabilitation in the wake of Perestroika, which was marked around 1988 by articles in the pages of Teatr Muusika Kino, his style had changed character again in response to its new close links to the musical institutions and marketplace conditions of Western Europe. For example, just listen to the contrasting sounds of Perth's piece Wenn Bach Bienen gezüchtet hätte, as first performed in 1976, and then as revised in the mid-1980s. These changes, I think, had little to do with Estonia, but to the rest of the world, Perth, with his revamped 1980s sound, now personified Estonian music. Since 1991, Estonia has sought to re-establish its identity, politically and also culturally, as an independent nation. But the aesthetic imagery that had built up around Perth during his exile newly challenged attempts to portray him as a national composer. Jeffers Engelhardt writes that Perth did not fit conveniently into the cultural and political narratives of the 1990s the way Valjo Tormis did. He had been absent for the entire, crucial 1980s. His Tintinnabuli music was difficult, expensive, unsuited for mass amateur performance, mostly unconnected with the Estonian language. His religious devotion, so integral to the Western marketing, was also an issue. As Urve Lipus once commented, there have always been doubts in Estonia whether Christianity can be considered at all as a source of inspiration. Perth did not immediately return to live in post-Soviet Estonia, and he has never had a pedagogical role at an Estonian university. But of course, many efforts have also been made to overcome these conceptual tensions. Hert has been symbolically linked with Estonia through important state commissions, such as Fyr Lennart in memoriam, and also, I think, through the activities of the Arvo Pärt Centre. And of course, he regularly receives Jubilee festivals and performances. Meanwhile, ever since the late 1990s, the Pärt sound has increasingly returned to the custodianship of Estonian performers, most particularly conductors and choirs. And so, this question of Pärt's music and Estonian identity, I think, is still open. I feel that this topic has been hard for modern Estonian scholars to write about. The political and cultural transitions of the late 20th century brought about significant reorientations in musicological method. To this, we may add the general difficulties faced by former republics in interrogating their own Soviet histories, a crucial exercise when it comes to understanding Pärt. Laura Dolp also suggests that it has been prohibitive to write critically about Pärt from within Estonia. Now, I cannot comment decisively on those matters. But it does seem to me that as the 21st century moves on, Estonia is increasingly able to define itself in ways that are not determined by opposition to the Soviet Union. As a cultured, cosmopolitan, developed country with high levels of European integration. And this notion of Estonia in some ways reflects a vision of Pärt recently described by Kevin Carnes, a figure whose emigration and fragmented biography actually make him representative of a Europe in transition, a figure whose history, music and dwelling places, whose languages, faith and even physical appearance planted him squarely on the imminently movable, possibly untenable, and perhaps even fading line between East and West. It requires some optimism, but perhaps a future generation of scholars will be able to understand both Pärt and his Estonianness as inseparable emblems of that worthy idea conjured by Carnes, a new post-historical Europe on the path to healing from the mass trauma of the old century. And I'd like to finish on that optimistic note, the note on which, as Tuomas Siitonen himself put it so well a few years ago, Pärt's music conveys the courage to live in our present world. For me, it is quite powerful to try to imagine those moments in the station at Brest, both violent and beautiful, Pärt and his family going one way, Siitonen another. It reminds me of the complex and contradictory histories, the experiences of individuals, of countries, and even of continents that the Tintinnabuli style traverses, and it spurs me on to keep asking questions about the music of this remarkable composer. Aitäh.